I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a look behind the closed doors of conservative Saudi Arabia. We'll have our conversation with the 25-year-old Saudi author of the book that's caused a firestorm in the Arab world. It's called Girls of Riyadh. But first, ABC News is reporting that a small al-Qaeda cell is either on its way to the United States or already here, and that a trail of information left by the alleged attackers in Britain has provided new intelligence. This, as Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff told the Chicago Tribune editorial board, he has a gut feeling about a possible al-Qaeda attack. And the White House has called top intelligence and law enforcement to a meeting tomorrow afternoon to deal with a threat. Brian Ross is chief investigative correspondent for ABC News. He joins us with more. And Brian, your reporting of this increased risk, Chertoff's gut feeling, Americans might feel they've heard this before, and cynics might say, you know, it dovetails neatly with discontent over the Iraq war. So how are your sources characterizing this, the level of this threat?
The level of the information, it's an intelligence report, is good but not hard. And by that I mean no specifics that we could find as to when or where, but a serious operation, they believe, underway. And as you say, it coincides with other intelligence and the statements and comments by Michael Chertoff yesterday.
Right. And let's talk about that other intelligence, because you were saying that the alleged attackers in Glasgow and London were somewhat sloppy in that they left a trail. What does that trail tell investigators in the U.S.?
Well, it gives them some insight into some of the other Internet messages that have been intercepted but deemed to be not important. Now, with a second look based on information, and I'm not sure exactly what it is they have, but something has given them reason to believe that those messages were significant, and that it leads them, I believe, to possible U.S. Targets.
Right. And you reported earlier this month that a secret U.S. law enforcement report prepared for the Department of Homeland Security warned that al-Qaeda is planning a terror spectacular this
right.
summer. Those are pretty weighted words.
They really are, and I was surprised to hear that and felt it was worthy of reporting. And based on that, they've stepped up coverage of flights into and out of the U.S., but into the U.S. from European cities, in fact, including Glasgow and Prague, the Czech Republic.
I know you're speaking to people off the record who wish to remain anonymous, but can you give us a sense, you know, are they comparing this kind of chatter, this intelligence, to anything else they've seen? Is there some relativity here?
Some compare it to the level of chatter and sense of something coming to the summer 6 years ago, the summer of 2001, prior to the 9/11 attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Clark, who was then the counterterrorism chief at the White House, now a consultant for ABC News, was telling me in that summer there was high chatter and a sense something was coming in June or July, and then in August it went suddenly quiet, and they thought the threat may have passed. In fact, it was just in its final stages. The chatter now is described also as very high, very active. And on top of that is this concern that al-Qaeda really has gone through a resurgence with a new safe haven in Pakistan, very well entrenched. It was interesting to a number of people yesterday when the number two man in al-Qaeda, the Egyptian doctor Ayman al-Zawahiri, in his eighth taped message of the year, talked about his easy access to the Internet, how he was reading on the Internet. And what that says to the intelligence officials is that if he's reading the Internet, he probably has the ability to communicate via the Internet. And that, from their point of view, is very dangerous and the kind of thing that allows what they call kind of al-Qaeda Central to reestablish itself. There's more money flowing in there, we're told, and they have the ability now to finance bigger possible operations.
Ayman al-Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda leader, threatened Britain with more attacks. He accused Britain of defying the Islamic world by honoring the novelist Salman Rushdie with a knighthood last month in this recent tape. Well, given all of this, is the Department of Homeland Security going to raise the color-coded terrorism threat levels? I mean, what are people supposed to do, I guess, is what Americans always feel when they hear this.
The frustration is they're not exactly sure what to tell Americans to do, so they haven't really raised the level at this point because, as they say, there's no specific credible information about an imminent threat. But those words are chosen very carefully. It doesn't mean there's not a general feeling, as Michael Chertoff said yesterday, there's something in the gut, but that in general there's a sense that something's coming, but they don't know where or when, so they really can't issue the kind of warnings that might be helpful. I guess what they're really saying is people should be vigilant.
Brian Ross, Chief Investigative Correspondent for ABC News. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, when Raja Alsana hears this kind of news, she is acutely aware that Westerners think immediately of her home country, Saudi Arabia. Raja straddles both worlds. She's a graduate student in dentistry in Chicago. She's also author of one of the most provocative books printed in the Arab world in modern times. It's a tale of four well-educated young women looking for love. Not shocking by Western standards, but set that story in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where a woman can still be stoned for kissing in public, and watch out. That's what Raja found out after her debut novel, Girls of Riyadh, came out in 2005. It caused a sensation because it dared to mention briefly premarital sex, women tasting a drink, and driving. Tame for most Western readers, but taboo in Muslim Saudi Arabia. And the book also tells of arranged marriages that leave unloved wives wilting on the vine. Well, Raja's book was banned in the kingdom. She received death threats, but she also received thousands of emails from readers saying how much they appreciated the book. A professor of Arabic literature at Hebrew University said girls would be seen as an historical turning point of social reform. And Raja was elected the most important cultural figure of 2006 by one Arabic paper. A heavy title, and maybe an unwanted one for this now 25-year-old. Girls in Riyadh has just been published in English. The book's narrator, who runs a fictional online chat room, begins by quoting Lebanese poet Nizar Kobani, who writes despairingly about her girlfriends and thousands of martyrs, all female, buried, stripped of their names in the graveyard of traditions. Author Raja Alsana joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I loved this poem. The women that she writes of, girlfriends, you know, lives sucked dry by jail, magazine pages that consume women's time, dolls swathed in gauze in a museum they lock, coins in history's mint, never given, never spent. Are these women that you know?
Not necessarily. The book describes women in Saudi Arabia, my generation specifically, and the middle to upper class mainly. It does not reflect my friends or people that I personally know, but it does reflect a generation and an era nowadays in Saudi Arabia.
And what do you mean? What do you take the line to mean, you know, history's coins never spent?
I feel that life is changing, especially for women in Saudi Arabia. They're starting to fight for a little bit more respect and freedom in Saudi Arabia. I have to say that it is not as bad as people think in the West, but women in Saudi Arabia are trying to carve their way in traditions and in religion and in a lot of restrictions that they have around them. And they're trying just to find the best way to live their lives normally, just like women anywhere else in the world.
Well, and it can be so confusing as they, as you say, try to carve their way because there are conflicting messages between the old world and the new. The young women you write about are members of the so-called privileged velvet class. They live in a world of, you know, fashion and beautiful weddings, perhaps plastic surgery abroad. But also they have their husbands chosen for them at times, or they're not sure how to behave around them. Let's just, you know, take the example of one. Sadim, she is just chased by Walid, who seems to adore her. And so at one point she decides, they're set to be married, to put on a black lace nightgown. She strews red petals around a sofa, has candles, soft music, and maybe, you know, goes a little bit further than she would have and decides to give Walid what she thinks Walid wants.
The way that I described it is very local because it's after the marriage. It's not before. They were not dating. They're officially married. But they did not have the wedding ceremony yet.
And what happens is he divorces her. He calls the wedding off.
That's true. In Saudi, women have to be very careful with their reputation and they have to respect their religion and they have to respect the family traditions. And Sadim was just a little bit outgoing, if I may say, and she just wanted to do what she feels is right. And I don't want to be critical of whatever happened or whatever I wrote in the book, because I loved describing things that happened in Saudi Arabia without trying to be judgmental of them, just to carry this culture around and let people know how things go in Saudi Arabia sometimes.
Well, and we should say your novel has a unique format. It's a year of emails written by an anonymous female narrator for her internet chat group. And she gets, as every chapter opens, she gets response to the last installment, the last story that she's told. And, you know, I'm wondering if it echoed the response that you got in real life, because, for instance, when Walid divorced Sadim, people responded to that. How did real life readers of your book respond to her being, you know, heartbroken and dumped?
I was shocked by the amount of emotions that people had towards these girls, because suddenly they see their daughters in these girls, and they see their sisters and their wives in these girls that I described in my book. I have to say that especially men were touched by the novel, and they felt what women go through after reading this novel. A lot of men told me that they sat with their daughters and they discussed things with them more openly than before. I remember specifically a man who married his daughter to somebody that didn't love her, and she got divorced after a couple of years and got two children, told me that it was very touching for him when his daughter gave him the book and told him to read it, because she could not tell him what she's been going through after her divorce. And it was just very overwhelming to see how people are getting affected by what I wrote.
Let's hear about some of the other stories. There's the traditional Gamra. She's left a single parent when her arranged marriage falls apart because she discovers her husband has a lover and really felt more love for the lover than he did for Gamra, the one his family picked him to marry. There's the outsider Michelle, whose beloved won't marry her, and his heart is broken, but he can't marry her because her mother is American. His mother doesn't approve. The rebel Lamis, who finds a love match, but gets arrested by the religious police for publicly meeting a man who's not a relative. She also dresses as a man to drive her friends to the mall. Just tell us some of the ways people responded to each.
People said that not everything known can be told. That's what everybody kept telling me. Not everything known can be told. They said that these are really personal stories, and even though those girls do not exist in real life, exposing Saudi women like that would damage the reputation of Saudi women. When I sat down to write this book, I did not think of breaking taboos or just writing about things that nobody have ever written before about. I just wanted to describe what we're going through as girls in Saudi Arabia. I wanted to show how confusing the traditions can be sometimes, and how sometimes we feel suffocated by these traditions.
That's Raja Alsana. She's the 25-year-old author of Girls of Riyadh. It caused a firestorm when it was first published in the Arab world. It's now out in English. We'll have more with Raja about her own conflicting feelings about being a Saudi woman. And later in the show, isn't it great that Harry Potter turned so many kids into readers? Wait a minute. Maybe he didn't. That's later. More after the break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Saudi author Raja Alsana. Her debut novel, Girls of Riyadh, has just been published in English. It tells of four privileged young women hoping to find true love in the conservative Muslim kingdom. Arranged marriages fail. Hearts are broken when families block true love matches. Its candidness shocked Arab readers when it was first published in 2005, when Raja was 23 years old. Raja, you say you want to shake off some of the suffocating traditions, make a distinction between those and religion. You say that's confusing, and it is for outsiders as well. For instance, you've recently chosen to wear a headscarf.
That's true, because that's a religious choice. It's not a traditional thing. My family never told me to wear it, and I've just started wearing it a couple of years ago.
So you're doing it for God and not for
Not for people, not because I don't want to be judged as a girl who does not wear the Islamic clothing, and not because my family told me to, and not because I want to get married to somebody who told me to wear it. It's just for me. I'm doing it because it is written in Quran, and I want to do it for God.
Some of the images that stay with me from your book, Raja, young girls going to the mall, they have money to spend. Unmarried men following them are stopped by security guards. They're not allowed in the mall with the girls at night. Girls smuggling films into their school. They're watching Braveheart and The Nutty Professor. Seeing all of this, you know, American Western culture. Valentine's Day has been canceled by the religious police. One of the young men gives a girl a basket filled with red roses and candles and a bear and a velvet heart. When you press the bear, Barry Manilow's Can't Smile Without You comes out. So they have these, you know, on the one hand, Valentine's Day is illegal. On the other hand, they're getting gifts from young men who then maybe reject them if they give them too much of a response.
It's a whole new world, I guess, to the Western reader to know about. I'm trying to say that we are not so different from anywhere else in the world. People fall in love and out of love in Saudi Arabia, just like anywhere else. The way they meet is different. The limits that they have or they put for themselves are different. It's not as easy as meeting someone outside Saudi Arabia and falling in love and getting married.
We spoke of how people applauded you for the book and thanked you for the book, but you've also received death threats. Tell us about that negative reaction.
Well, I published the book in Lebanon. I did not publish it in Saudi Arabia. When I wrote the book, I showed it to my family, and after they read it, they were asking me if I'm ready to go through with the publication, and they asked me if I'm worried about the consequences of publishing such a controversial book. And I said, yes, I am totally aware of what can happen. My brother suggested that I publish it under a fake name, and I said, no, I was very proud of what I did. We joked when he said that I might lose a lot of marriage proposals because of what I wrote. amazingly, I got a lot of marriage proposals after I published the book.
But you also got death threats.
I did get death threats through email. I did get some people tried to sue me. I just simply sat down and wrote a novel that describes what I see, and I was not trying to hammer the Saudi women or to criticize them, because I am a Saudi girl and I want to go back to Saudi and live there and raise my children there when I ever have children.
You do?
Some people, I'm definitely going back, and I'm proud of being Saudi.
Would you want your daughter to be in an arranged marriage?
No. No, and I don't. She doesn't have to be. If I'm going to marry the right person, and if my family allows me to choose the man that I want to get married to, then I'm going to give that to my daughter as well.
Hmm. Do you think your book has or will change things in Saudi Arabia for women?
I hope so. I did not have that in mind when I wrote the book. I thought that it is nice to document our voice as young women in the 21st century in Saudi Arabia. We don't have any novels that represent us. Everything written was outdated, in my opinion, and it might create some sort of discussion. I've heard that there were more than 50 novels published in Saudi Arabia in 2006, half of them by women and half of them were by first-time authors, and they all described love in Saudi Arabia and life in Saudi Arabia. It's very good to have that open discussion in Saudi Arabia, and I don't know if it's going to change things in the coming 2 years or 4 years, but it can certainly change things on the long run.
Well, I'm just wondering, because just in the course of our talking, just at times, you sounded maybe just a little bit defensive about the book, and I'm wondering if you're concerned that the book is going to be seen by people as being sort of this complete slam of how women are treated in Saudi Arabia. And
That's true. That's very true. I feel that with what's going on around the world and with terrorism and with what's going on in politics, people outside Saudi Arabia are waiting for anything that can give them a sense of why Saudis act like that, or why do Saudi women live under male dominance, or why do some of the terrorists are Saudis. And I feel that I'm afraid that I will be used in this battle between countries and between cultures, and I want to be the voice, the young voice of Saudi women, but at the same time I want people to respect my country and respect the differences between Saudi culture and other cultures.
Well, we wish you the best.
Thank you so much.
Raja Alsani is author of The Girls of Riyadh. Her 2005 novel is now available in English language translation. Raja, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, a former Surgeon General says the Bush administration censored him on sensitive public health issues. Will that impact tomorrow's confirmation hearing for the president's new choice for Surgeon General? And still ahead today, teens and books. Will they pick one up when Harry Potter's gone? And some recommendations to get them to do just that. That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's Harry Potter's world. We just live in it. Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, the film based on book 5 in the best-selling series, opens today. Then next week, the 7th and final book of author J.K. Rowling's phenomenal franchise will hit bookstores around the world. So when we reach the last chapter of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, we'll finally know the fate of the boy wizard. Does he live or die? Either way, booksellers are already mourning the end of his story. More than 325 million copies of the books have been printed in 66 different languages. And Harry has been given credit for getting kids everywhere into bookstores and libraries, into books. But wait a minute. What's this? A study to be released in the fall says even Harry may not have been able to perform enough magic to get kids to keep reading beyond his books. Reporter David Mahegan writes about this in the Boston Globe. Welcome, David.
Hello, Robin.
We're also joined by Paula Brumheger. She's president-elect of the Young Adult Library Service Association and manager of the teen department at the Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library in Cincinnati, Ohio. Paula, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Robin.
And first of all, but just Paula, are you, you know, you have a big event planned? Are you a lot of celebrating when the book comes out?
Absolutely. We have a number of branches here that are having read-ins on Saturday, but we do have one location that's actually hosting a midnight Harry Potter party, the book in the hands of young people right when it's released at midnight.
Sure, 12:01. They'll be there in their little wizard hats and everything. But David, dampening the excitement is this study. What is this study, and what does it say about kids reading?
It made me feel like a terrible killjoy, Robin. Mm-hmm. But I talked with Dana Gioia, who's the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, about a study that they'd done 2 years ago called Reading at Risk, which had indicated that the reading really is, leisure reading is really dropping in this country. And he indicates that while reading advances greatly between ages 7 and 11, when kids reach high school, it really crashes because all the pressure is toward video games and other sorts of things. And the kids are not really reading very much, notwithstanding Harry Potter, in that age group.
And Paul, and this seems so counterintuitive because so many of us are seeing these kids devour these 700-plus page books. They're huge. A lot of parents won't let the kids see the movies till they read the books. But do you see this happening at the library, that those Harry Potter fans don't continue as they get older?
Well, at the library, we see a lot of interest in fantasy in general, I think as related to Harry Potter. So we do have a lot of kids that come in and ask for other books that might be of interest to them that are like Harry Potter. And certainly the kids that are reading Harry Potter are coming in and asking for additional recommendations.
Is this like the Cirque du Freak series that we hear about?
Sure, you have that. You have the Aragon series. It was something of a little phenomenon. There are a number of them. The Lightning Thief by Rick Riordan is a series, and I think it's that series element that a lot of teens are particularly interested in, perhaps because of Harry Potter.
Yeah, but, you know, again, according to the National Endowment for the Arts study that's going to come out in the fall, and again, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress, that's a series of federal tests the Times reports on today, the percentage of kids who read for fun. It's amazing, the numbers, David. I'm looking, it drops from 43% in fourth grade to 19% in eighth grade. That was in 98 and again in 2005. Why do people think that is?
Well, I think that there's competition from other activities. There's video games, there's IMing with their friends, there's overall, above all, there's television. And of course, we see kids going into bookstores and to libraries, buying, or taking out books or buying books and enjoying books. And of course, we see that and we notice that, but maybe we don't notice the kids who don't come in. Mm. I think there's a craze for Harry Potter, but it's like, you know, it's like a craze for red hula hoops when all the other hula hoops are not selling. There's an enormous number of people who are reading these books and books like them and who love them, but who knows how many kids there are. There must be 80 million kids between 10 and 18 in this country. Even if a few million are reading Harry Potter, there's an awful lot, apparently, who are not.
Well, and some teachers are saying, you know, inner-city kids aren't, as in some cases, as interested in it. It doesn't reflect their lives. There aren't that many minority characters in the books. And, David, you write that there's some other surprising facts, despite Potter's success. Booksellers aren't really making money off the series, and books for younger kids in particular have been neglected.
That was 2 points that were made to me by those I talked to in the course of my story. The discounting, the extreme heavy discounting by the big retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, almost 50% discounts, they're really a loss leader. They're practically giving the book away. Means that smaller booksellers, the ones who have the parties, the local independent bookstores, they cannot compete on price, and so there are actually many of them selling fewer books than ever. Mm-hmm. So they have a big party, and kids are showing up at the party at 20 minutes past midnight with a book that they bought at Walmart, wanting mm-hmm. to go to the party. So that's one kind of unfortunate thing. Small booksellers are having a hard time. And then there are those who feel that the increase in attention to middle-grade hardcover fiction has allowed a neglect of picture books for smaller children. And that, some people think that that's kind of a sad thing.
Well, Paula, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second. An educator, Michael Camel, a professor of education at Stanford University, is quoted in the Times today saying, you know, I think people should be reading, but he feels we're overemphasizing reading of fiction. He says instead kids need to learn to read for information, and that's exactly what they're practicing while they're spending all those hours on the internet. You don't, you know, the Harry Potter books, he's implying, they're not going to come in handy when you go out into the work world.
Well, reading is a tool that, of course, we all need, and I think that the idea that we have to use everything in our toolbox to really engage young people in reading. So perhaps fiction isn't the only thing they would read. Nonfiction is very popular. We also have downloadable audiobooks. Things like audiobooks are things that librarians use to draw them in. And certainly any time that young people are reading for informational purposes to figure out how to do something, perhaps to create content for a web page, all of those things definitely, I think, are valuable activities for them to be engaged in and relate to their reading skills.
Well, I'm going to jump in and perhaps say the thing that maybe you're too polite to say. I think that's nuts that kids don't need that much fantasy reading. I mean, it's reading books in the summer. It's just letting your head daydream is just the greatest place to go. So, Paula, while we have you, tell us, you know, what are some of your recommendations to get teens to either, you know, keep the reading habit after Harry Potter, or, you know, to launch them if they didn't get launched by Harry?
Well, we have seen The Book Thief is a book by Marcus Zusak, which is an award-winning book and has been extremely popular as well. There have been Uglies, which is a series by Scott Westerfeld, which is sort of science fiction, fantasy, lots of popularity there. Stephanie Meyer's series Twilight and New Moon, very popular. There's a new one in that series coming out. A lot of young people are looking for that one. Then we have series like Warriors by Aaron Hunter and Pendragon by David McHale. These are also both series that young people wait for the next book. They email us as soon as they know it's coming out, and they want to know when is it going to be at the library, when can they check it out. So mm-hmm. I think that there are plenty of books that they're really interested in reading and continuing to read in a series format.
Okay, I can just see parents now, wait, I want to write that down. We'll have all of those books at our website, here-now.org. That's Paula Bremheger, president-elect of the Young Adult Library Service Association and manager of the teen department at the Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library in Cincinnati, Ohio. We also spoke with David Mahegan with the Boston Globe. One last quick question to both of you before we go. Do you think he dies in the last book?
I'm going to say I doubt it. It just seems to me And I don't know anyone who thinks that he will, which is probably a bad sign, but I think he probably will. He'll be back.
I absolutely agree with David. I really can't believe in my heart that he is going to die now.
Because I'm telling you, August is going to be a rough month. That's what happens. Thank you both.
You're welcome, Robin.
Thank you.
Okay, before we go today, you're going to hear about it. It's Ooey, It's Gooey. It has a nifty theme song, but it'll also eat you alive. It's The Blob. You're listening to Here and Now. There's a California gold rush of sorts going on in the honeybee industry. Many East Coast beekeepers and their hives are heading west with the prospect of major profits that can be had from pollinating California's booming almond industry. But that money comes with a catch. A devastating sickness is causing millions of bees to die off, and no one knows why. Now beekeepers are weighing the cost of taking their hives clear across the country. Here now's Kevin Donovan has the story.
Wesley Card is a second-generation apiarist, or beekeeper, whose family-owned business handles some 320 million bees out of their home in Billerica, Massachusetts.
I've been getting stung since I was, hardly able to walk, so for me, it's no big deal, really. It's kind of like a dairy farmer and having to deal with the smell of manure.
Right now, it's cranberry season here, and Card is pollinating acres of cranberry flowers blooming across the state. I'm with him at a cranberry bog, where he's checking on his hives.
These are the hives here. They won't be flying too much. It's kind of late in the day, and it's overcast, so... Or they will be.
Oh, wow.
That looks pretty good.
The hives are swarming with thousands of bees.
That makes me happy.
I don't know if it makes me happy.
The cranberry is one of many crops, from apples to blueberries and almonds, that almost completely depends on bee pollination. There's an old adage farmers believe, we owe one in every four bites of food to the honeybee. But that food is under attack by a mysterious sickness that's wiping out thousands of hives. Scientists call it colony collapse disorder, or CCD. One day, the beekeeper checks his hives, and the bees are gone. Not dead, but gone. By some estimates, a quarter of the nation's bee population has been wiped out by CCD. There's a lot of theories why.
I can certainly discount crop circles, aliens, and the rapture as possible causes.
But Kim Kaplan of the U.S. Department of Agriculture says nearly everything else that could kill a bee is still on the table. A rare fungus, tiny mites, viruses, or even the burden of long bouts of travel. Cross-country drives on the back of a tractor trailer with the heat, wind, and fumes is a potentially disastrous combination of factors for a crate of honeybees. Kaplan says all that travel also makes it hard for beekeepers to pin down where CCD is coming from.
If they were in five states during a four-month pollination period, what state would you say CCD happened in if they reported CCD, their home state, or one of those five states they were in during the pollination? That's part of what makes this issue so complicated.
But the lure of California's massive almond crop has turned the modern beekeeper into a full-time road warrior. In the East, renting a hive of bees costs about $70. Out West, that same hive can go for $140 or more. Again, Wesley Card.
We were one of the first beekeepers to go to almonds from the East Coast. In fact, we were the first to load a truck and drive it across the country and say... and take that risk that the bees weren't just going to die on the truck in 3 days of travel. And now everybody's going to California for the obvious economic benefits.
Card says he's spending much more tending to the hive to assure it can survive the long trips and any diseases it picks up along the way. And bee experts have come up with some safety nets to assure fruits and nuts still get pollinated. One idea gaining traction, increase the number of wild bees in the forests and fields. In the industry jargon, they're called native pollinators. Brian Wick works with the Cape Cod Cranberry Growers Association.
What we're doing is trying to help with the native pollinators. Even though they play a small role in the pollination, we're looking at one aspect of helping the situation out is if we can increase the amount of native pollinators that are out there through habitat and best management practices, then that will help take some of the pressure off of a potential colony collapse disorder affecting cranberries.
The USDA says it is currently working on a study that could narrow down what's causing CCD. Until then, beekeepers say all they can do is wait and hope for the best.
I say, hey there, little insect, don't scare me so.
Don't land on me, baby, it bite me low. I say, hey there, little insect, please calm down. Then we'll have fun and fool around.
Here now is Kevin Donovan in Billerica, Massachusetts. To see pictures of beekeepers at work, go to our website, here-now.org. Coming up, Blob Fest 2007.
It's kind of like a mass that keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
It's kind of like a mass that keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Come on, Steve, makes sense.
Look, Dave, you've got to see this thing to believe what I'm telling you.
Maybe the thing you saw was a monster?
It sure was, and not just any monster, but the Blob, that oozing mass from outer space that rocketed into small-town Pennsylvania and promptly started devouring citizens there. Well, on Friday the 13th, no less, the Blob is making a comeback in tiny Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, just an hour outside Philly, where parts of the film were shot in 1957. In fact, the Blob will air this weekend in the same theater, the Colonial, that was featured in the film. Blobfest 2007 kicks off a two-day celebration of all things blobby, and joining us is Phoenixville's official blobologist, Shane Stone. Really? Are you, is there a title?
Right. That's, I guess I was bestowed the title. I certainly did not give that to myself. So.
Well, yes, because we understand that, well, first of all, this weekend some of the film's original cast and crew are going to be there. You're going to have a screaming contest, but It all starts with a reenactment at the Colonial Theater of one of the movie's most memorable scenes. I mean, let's listen. Who can forget when all the townspeople fled the theater because the Blob ate the projectionist?
Don't go in, Jen. This won't do any good. It's the most horrible thing I've ever seen in my life. Come on, we've got to clear this area.
And then everybody comes running down the street.
Yeah. It sounds like that every year still.
Well, we understand you're going to lead this reenactment. What are you going to do this year?
There's always some kind of surprise that will be the cue for everyone to run out of the theater.
Oh.
So really what we have on Friday night is kind of more of like the old-time variety shows. We have a rockabilly band. We have a tinfoil hat contest along with the scream contest. You never know. Maybe the winner of the scream contest will get up and give us the signal this year or whatnot. So.
You wacky people there in Phoenixville. I should, full disclosure here, I'm in Phoenixville all the time. My sister lives there. And you know, the town has changed somewhat. You can see, well, there's coffee shops now, and new businesses seem to be moving in. It seems to be getting a little zip in its step. Do you think the Blob has anything to do with that? Do you think that, you know?
Of course it does. Yeah, just that whole down, you know, small town, do-it-yourself, stick-to-itiveness.
You know, make your own movie and then keep making it come back.
Exactly. Like Bridge Street, right there in front of the theater, it's gone through several incarnations throughout the years and whatnot, but there's always seems to be the same group of folks that have always had the family restaurant or whatnot, and they're sticking around. There's that Main Street life there. It's like stepping back into the 50s or 60s. Mm. It really is something neat that you just don't see a whole lot of anymore.
And in parts of Phoenixville, you know, when you drive down these quaint Main Streets, you feel like you're back in time. Are there people there who were in that famous scene running out of the theater?
Right, there are still a few around. We actually have a gal, Marianne DiCarlo, who was very prominent in the running out scene. If you see the scene, she's the gal who gets kind of yanked down and really sprawled out and gets knocked down in the movie. So we're going to be giving her a special award this year. So she's going to come out and join us to help us out with the festivities and whatnot. So we do still have a handful of locals that come out every year.
Well, let's remind those who didn't see the film a little bit more about it. First of all, the actor that everyone remembers is Steve Andrews. He played by Steve McQueen. He spends most of the movie, at first he's, you know, sort of with his girlfriend, and this is 1958, they're driving in the car, and that's, you know, about as far as it goes. But suddenly there's this, they think a shooting star, they go try to follow it, an old man finds it first, and out of this sort of big walnut comes this blobby thing. Mm-hmm. And they take him to the doctor, and the Blob eats the old man, eats the doctor, and now Steve McQueen has to convince other people of the approaching menace. Let's listen.
This town is in danger. Now, several people have been killed already. Now we had to make this noise. We had to make it so you'd listen to us, so we could warn you.
What's going on here, Jim?
Steve, Dave, make them listen to me. There is a monster. We saw it again in Dad's store. Dave, it's bigger now.
Your story's gotten bigger now, kid.
Dave, look at me. Do I look like somebody's playing a practical joke? Am I laughing? Or am I scared stiff?
Steve McQueen in The Blob. Shane Stone, again, blobologist for Phoenixville. Mm-hmm. Set this in context for us. I said 1958. This was in the midst of the Cold War. Some said The Blob was a metaphor for creeping communism.
Right. I've heard that. We've never had that really actually confirmed. It's a good question. We're going to have Jack Harris, the film's producer, will be at Blobfest this year. So I'm sure plenty of people are going to ask him about that because that's one of the floating rumors, and he's never really confirmed or denied it. So another one that I'd heard was, you know, it's, you know, the blob gets redder with the blood of victims that it consumes, because if you see it in the very beginning, it is actually a little clearer looking, and then it gets redder and redder. And again, that, you know, is another metaphor for, say, the communism, the Red Scare and whatnot. So you got to wonder if that was intentional or did it just kind of happen and people kind of read more into it after the fact.
By the way, what was the blob? You know, how did they make that thing?
It's just a big glob of silicone dyed red. And what they would do is just take a handful of this stuff, warm it up a little bit under the lamps, and then it would actually kind of ooze, and they had miniatures of the theater and the street scenes and whatnot, and would just shoot it and then tilt the miniature, and it would ooze down the set. That made it appear like it was moving. So really, it's just a big glob of silicone.
Okay, now parents are going to be grossed out. I'm sorry, but it's sort of like that fake snot that you can buy in a store. That's sort of what it's like. Well, we want to play the last scene from the movie. This is Steve McQueen and Earl Rowe as Lieutenant Dave.
Uh-huh.
Now, the blob at this point has been frozen after it glommed over the entire Downington Diner, which is a terrific diner still.
Uh-huh.
The townspeople attack it with fire extinguishers, which is why you're also having a fire extinguisher parade this weekend.
Right.
And the fire extinguishers freeze it. So let's listen.
What are they going to do with that thing, Dave?
Well, the Air Force is sending a Globemaster in. They're flying it to the Arctic.
It's not dead, is it?
No, it's not.
Just frozen.
I don't think it can be killed, but at least we've got it stopped.
Yeah, as long as the Arctic stays cold.
Wait a minute. As long as the Arctic stays cold.
Yeah, timely, isn't it?
The scene, the film ends, you see a plane dropping the blob into the alleged Arctic waters.
Right.
And a big question mark appears on the screen. 50 years ago, they seem to be saying, but will the Arctic stay cold? Now scientists are telling us it's not.
Our theme for this year's Blobfest is an inconvenient blob. So we're really kind of playing up the global warming aspect and kind of doing a civic duty there as well. It's like, let's give a little bit back to the planet, but also it ties in pretty well with our event here.
Well, we can't let you go without hearing the movie's theme song, Beware the Blob, written by Burt Bacharach and Mac David.
Of all people.
As we listen, what a goofy thing, but wildly popular.
Right.
Why did they go with this?
I wonder if it had anything to do with budget constraints or whatnot, because, of course, we all know Burt Bacharach now, but back then, he was just getting a start. So I'm just wondering, hey, wow, this guy's got a song he'd like to contribute. Maybe I can, get this out, and we don't have to pay somebody a big budget or whatnot. Who knows? But I'm really glad they used it, because it is so catchy.
He just happened to have a song about a blob.
Right, yeah, I got one for you.
Shane Stone, child psychologist, and the town of Phoenixville, Pennsylvania's official blobologist. Blobfest 2007 gets underway there Friday. For more, go to our website, fear-now.org. Shane, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Beware of the blob. It creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch. Be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Medson, Hitesh Hati, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugars is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Chris Cuff, Ben Singer, Emily's Reddy, and Mahoney. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
And glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.